high-income taxpayers and big, complex multinational businesses.
Joe, any final thoughts you would like to share with us regarding the issue of providing the IRS the funds that it needs to carry out its job?
Yeah, I think that people need to remember that this is not just about increasing tax revenues from wealthy households, right? For ordinary people, a better funded IRS, an adequately staffed IRS, means fewer headaches. Most people, you're trying to file your taxes adequately, honestly, on time, and it just takes way too much time and costs way too much money. And it doesn't have to be that way. Having an adequately staffed IRS means that there will be people there to actually pick up phones. In prior years, the IRS had satisfactorily answered just 15% of phone calls. Last year, the first tax year after they had the new funding, it resolved 85% of phone calls. And for most people, that's still too low, but that's a remarkable improvement in 1 year. The $20 billion rescission passed last week is very unfortunate. I suppose it was politically necessary given the dynamics of the House of Representatives right now, and it will increase the deficit by all accounts. But what we need now is for lawmakers to stop there and protect the agency and make sure that the agency is adequately staffed and funded, and that's for the benefit of regular taxpayers and for the government's fiscal health.
Well, Joe Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next time.
I'm Mr. KBO of Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Hello, welcome to a very special edition of Film of 11. Joining me are, of course, Lisa Neville of University of New York, Cortland, Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time and other light masterpieces of radio technology. We're doing what we occasionally do, which is devote an entire half of an hour to one specific film. And in this case, it is the film It Should Happen to You, which stars Judy Holliday and Jack Lemmon in his first appearance, and Peter Lawford in an additional role, released in 1954, written by Garson Kanin, a prominent playwright at the time, and directed by George Cukor, one of the Hollywood greats.
Are you a New Yorker?
Only since about less than 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Are you?
Well, 10 years, still not used to it. I'm from Westfield, New Jersey.
You know, the one thing I can't understand about New York is why everybody here is so unfriendly.
I've wondered the same thing myself. Where are you from?
Binghamton. That's upstate New York.
Pete Shepard. How do you do?
Thank you.
So, Lisa, tell us why you became so fascinated with this particular film.
I love Judy Holliday, who, if you have never seen her, she only made a handful of films. She died young, but she is a brilliant and intelligent and thoughtful comedian who made her films in the 1950s. She teamed up with Garrison Kanin, the writer. They were both progressives, both leftists in Hollywood at the time, and they made, I think, four films together. This film, It Should Happen to You, set in Manhattan. Judy Holliday is new to New York. She's come from out of town to sort of make her way. She meets cute Jack Lemmon in Central Park on a hot summer day. They get talking. Jack Lemmon's a documentary filmmaker. And they start talking about their lives and how they came to New York. And Judy Holliday confesses that she wants to be somebody.
Well, do you have a name?
Of course. Gladys Glover.
Oh, glad to know you, Gladys.
Thank you.
Gladys Glover, huh?
It's not much of a name.
Why do you say that?
Well, because nobody ever heard of it. And I guess nobody ever will.
Well, you mind that?
Of course.
Well, you're on the young side, but all that seems so important. After a while, you won't care so much.
Sure, because then it'll be too late.
And she attributes this motive to everyone. This is a universal motive. Everyone wants to be someone.
Wow.
Everybody wants to stand outside of the crowd. But she comes to New York and she's just one of the crowd. and she's very frustrated by this.
The whole reason I came to New York in the first place was to try and make a name for myself, and I haven't even gotten started on it. I'm getting nowhere. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, some people, when they get to that point where they realize that they're getting nowhere, you know, they just kill themselves. But I don't feel like it.
Well, that is a fairly drastic step.
The only other thing is to go back home. Do the same thing as everybody else. Go back to work in the shoe factory. Marry the first man that asks. Or the second. And then, goodbye. Name for yourself. Goodbye, dreams. In fact, goodbye, Charlie.
Jack Lemmon is kind of benevolently amused by this, but he sort of pushes back against it a little. You know, he says, what's so wrong with being part of the crowd? He says, privacy, and he says this to her several times, privacy is the most precious thing for most people. You know, and it's more important, he always says, to stand for something than to rise above. And so this is the conflict that they have, but nevertheless, they're a wonderful couple. He's attracted to her. He's delighted by her. She's lovely and sweet and stubborn, and she's attracted to him. And eventually, he moves into her apartment building, and they date for a while. But the point of the film, the sort of conceit of the film, is that Judy Holliday rents a billboard in Columbus Square, a huge billboard, and has her name put on it.
I want to see Mr. Pfeiffer, please.
Who?
Mr. Horace Pfeiffer. Isn't this his place?
This is the Horace Pfeiffer Company, but there is no Mr. Pfeiffer.
Excuse me.
Just what was this in reference to?
About the sign on Columbus Circle?
Yes.
Says it's for rent.
Yes.
Well, so who do I see in reference to it if there's no Mr. Pfeiffer, like you say?
Well, one moment. Well, that's Mr. Entrecote. Walk right down the hall and turn
so that everybody will see her name and she will rise above the crowd. And then she gets not just one billboard, but several more billboards. And people start to hear about her. And the film is basically about celebrification. She's the Paris Hilton, the Kim Kardashian of her day. She's somebody who becomes famous for being famous and nothing else. Everybody knows her name, but nobody knows quite what she stands for. What?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Even worse. Like the influencers, so-called influencers of today, there are hundreds of them, and I've never heard of any of them, and yet their names keep popping up on various websites I look at, such as Vulture, etc., about contemporary media.
Matthew reminded me there's a scene where she's in a department store shopping with Jack Lemmon, and one of the billboards, you can see it through the windows of the department store, and when she tells her name to the clerk says, are you her? And then suddenly a crowd amasses around her and she's her. But nobody knows, you know, what does her mean? It doesn't really mean anything.
Mama, would you mind?
What?
Would you mind signing this to my little niece? She collects the ocean. Get the biggest kick. Harold.
Yes.
Guess who this is?
Yes. I give up.
It's Gladys Glover.
No
she
kidding.
Gave me her autograph. I don't know.
Do you mind?
Of course not.
Like that faux celebrity in the 70s, Evangeline, who put up billboards of herself in Los Angeles and ended up famous for being busty and putting a billboard up about herself, but actually never done anything.
She eventually gets attracts the kind of parasite that, you know, one would attract, you know, when one's famous, and a kind of a manager who puts her in all of these different compromising positions. It becomes, her integrity gets chipped away at more and more.
Yeah, but do what? Once a month?
Yeah, look, Gladys, I don't know, figure something. Maybe just tell your story like you told it to me. It's funny.
Funny?
Well, fascinating.
I better not.
Yeah, that's right. Might be some cash in it.
There would?
Might. Of course, I'd expect my cut.
Oh, sure. Why not?
You sure you're not hooked up in any way, you two?
How do you mean?
No.
Well, like engaged or engaged to be engaged.
Look, mister.
Wait a second. Why?
Well, I was just thinking. There's this TV turn. I think they call it Man and Wife. You know, you get married right on a program. I understand it's quite a haul.
Really?
What are you looking at?
I don't know.
Look, Gladys, please don't get mixed up in anything more. You want to turn into a freak? Now, how do you think that anything...
Of course, there's that other program, The People Speak. They're always looking for goofballs.
Well, now, you hear that? You're a goofball.
No, look, that's just a figure of speech, son. Look, I happen to know this fellow who runs a program. Let me sound him. See what happens. Okay, honey?
Go ahead. Sound.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the story of...
So the film is about what happens to her, how that occurs, and the two men in her life. Jack Lemmon is pretty disgusted. The more intense the celebrification gets, the more he's fed up with it, and finally he leaves. Peter Lawford, on the other hand, is a rich sort of playboy who's fairly superficial to begin with, and he courts her, and there's this wonderful moment where she actually turns on him and tells him she's not resisting his advances merely because that is the appropriate thing to do for a woman in 1950s film. But in fact, she gets to choose who she sleeps with, and she doesn't want to sleep with him. And it's just this wonderful scene way ahead of its time, actually, where she asserts her sense of absolute individuality and turns on him.
I think I better be going.
Why?
Because I'm not enjoying myself.
Oh, give me time.
I don't mind the way you're acting exactly. What I mind is the way you give the idea you're sort of entitled.
Maybe I am.
Oh, well, sure. If you want to make it into a sort of business proposition.
Well, that's what you're doing, isn't it? If you're looking for true romances, Missy, the magazines are full of it,
but it looks to me, Mr. Adams, there are two kinds of people. The ones who'll do anything to make a name for themselves. And the ones who'll do almost anything.
And which are you?
I'll let you know.
Oh, now, wait a second.
No, you didn't really want to have a conference. At least not the kind I thought, anyway. You just said that.
Yeah, but after all...
And in the second place, and this is the most important thing, pretty soon there are going to be ads and signs all over that say about me being the average American girl. Your idea, wasn't it?
Well?
Well, I don't think the average American girl should do this. So, good night.
I think it's a sign of my increasing maturity as a human being that I found the scenes of his seduction of her, or attempted seduction, quite unnerving, if not distasteful.
They're cringeworthy, there's no doubt. Yeah.
Yet, at the same time, she said exactly the right thing, which is, I don't like you because you carry with yourself a sense of entitlement. And that is exactly what is the problem with American men of a certain generation when it comes to relations with the opposite sex. They feel entitled. I thought that at least that one line really addressed the discomfort that contemporary viewers might feel about the Me Too-ness of some of the plot. On the other hand, Jack Lemmon is not without his creepiness, because remember that he meets her in Central Park and then followed her.
I'd say, if you'd
found out where she lived,
care to give me your address, I could drop you a postcard and fix it up for you to see this picture when it gets done.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd give my right arm to see myself in the movies.
You have to give me your right arm, just give me your right address.
262
and then
West 60
moved into that apartment on the same floor with her. I mean, that's the other side of the aggressive male. That's the stalker type. It's very interesting that that is more acceptable because it's founded on a true love that he feels for her than Peter Lawford's careless, habitual attitude towards women and seduction.
Well, there's two differences with Jack Lemmon, and you hit one is, of course, that he has a completely different feelings and thus different intentions toward her. And secondly, Jack Lemmon is more than willing to accept no. The minute that she says no, he's added. He leaves. He does not push himself upon her. You're right. Mm. It's the romantic gesture of moving into her apartment building could be seen as somewhat stalkerish, but I was okay with it.
Well, I've kind of felt how the contrast the two men. We understand where they're both coming from. Jack Lemmon is attracted to her. Right from the start, he's looking at other people and she kind of stands out, and then he gets her address and he moves in. The Peter Lawford character, his father's company had always put their soap ads on that billboard, and here there was some mistake that it was open, and so she was able to rent it for this period of time. And so Peter Lawford's character is just doing business. Oh, we got to get this back. Oh, it's this woman. No. Well, we'll talk her out of it.
But she turns out to be a better negotiator than they anticipated.
So then they, in exchange for that billboard on Columbus Circle, they give her a bunch of other ones around town, and that starts to build her fame. And so then they want to start exploiting her fame, and so they start putting her in ads. And
well, there's two phases with the Peter Lawford romance, and that's the first phase, you're absolutely right, is manipulative.
Yeah.
But the second phase is opportunistic. I mean, he does then want to bed her. He just wants a conquest.
But then Lemon, he like really cares for her. That's why he's all upset about what she's doing. And he takes the time to explain, you know, what's wrong about having her name on the billboard.
What is the point of it? Where is it getting you? No place.
No place? I started out with no sign, so then I got one sign, so then I got six. So where do you get no place?
Let me put it this way. What most people, real people, want is privacy. Now, that's about the best thing anybody can have.
Not me.
What is this craze to get so well known?
Why craze?
Well, you think everybody is so anxious to be above the crowd?
Yes.
But what's the point of it? In the first place, everybody can't be above the crowd, can they?
No, but everybody can try if they want to.
But why isn't it more important to learn how to be a part of the crowd?
Not me.
It isn't just making a name. Don't you understand that, Gladys? The thing is making a name stand for something. Different names stand for different things.
So who said not?
You want my opinion?
No.
All right, now my opinion is this. It's better if your name stands for something on one block than if it stands for nothing or something bad all over the entire world.
I don't follow your point.
I sure wish you could. This thing is getting to be more in our way every day.
What do you mean, in our way?
Reason why I wanted to talk about this movie is that it was spot on for its time. It's the generation of a celebrification that's happening on almost every front now. Almost every line of endeavor is just creating its own celebrities. So we don't just have movie stars anymore. We have television stars and singing stars, and rock and roll is coming in. Artists and writers, and it's no longer enough to simply do the work. It's one has to become a celebrity who does the work. And so that's, I think, what Garson Kanin is seeing. But I don't know if they could possibly have foreseen what we have now.
Oh, no.
Which is just, this is just completely insane. Yeah. So there's this tendency, and it's been for, you know, since the beginning of time. I mean, Horace talked about this, Homer talked about it, about the impulse for people to have fame and renown in their community. But, and that's what Jack Lemmon's pushing back against. So yes, he's saying that that impulse to have fame and renown is in itself fairly meaningless. That what has to stand behind it, what has to be part of it, is to be an integral part of your community. He keeps saying you have to stand for something. There is something that one must do or contribute or participate in some way that matters in the world, that you are somebody if you do that. And it really doesn't matter if you're recognized or not, but if you're recognized without doing that, he's disgusted by that. That's vacuous.
Often whenever we see him, especially at the apartment, he's out on the stoop, he's amongst people, he's a part of his community. On the other hand, he's also servicing the media thing. He's making a documentary about Central Park, but of course he's trying to isolate ordinary people and show them what they're like. And then also he's wanting to present people to themselves. So he's interested in people as ordinary people. He's outer directed.
Yeah, no, he says that. He says he makes documentaries because he wants to show people their own lives. It's almost as what he wants to do is do. It is the other side of what Andy Warhol was talking about. I mean, he does believe that everyone is important, that everyone is a star in their own movie, and he wants to show people that. But that means there's a democracy to that. Everybody gets to be a star in their own movie. There's not just one star that's up here elevated that everybody's watching their movie. And I love that. So he's a documentary filmmaker who wants to let people be noticed, who aren't ordinarily noticed. And that's what draws him to her, because she is an extraordinary and interesting person. He doesn't think that people have to be cookie cutters. You know, she's unique and funny. And so he wants to make a movie about her. But what she wants is to be adored. She wants to be adored without being, without having contributed anything to him. So at the end of the film, after he's left and he's said goodbye to her by making a documentary film where he tells her goodbye. And she
really charming, really charming moment in the movie, the way she's watching it, and she's suddenly, she, the power of cinema is such that she keeps wanting to talk to him, or it's like he's actually there. But I interrupted, please.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's a wonderful, but then after, so we see him and he's going on with his life and he's making a new movie and he's making a film about the zoo. He wants us to see what the zoo animals see when they look out at us.
This really explores media. We're talking about a movie called It Should Happen to You from 1954, directed by George Cukor, written by Garson Kanin, and starring Jack Lemmon and Judy Holliday, the fabulous Judy Holliday. There's a scene in the middle where her name is called out from the TV, and she thinks someone is calling to her, and she turns around and responds to it.
In the
and
bar,
then they turn around and see that they're talking about her on the TV, and they go up closer to the TV.
That interrupts probably the most tender scene between, there's two really wonderful tender scenes between Jack Lemmon and Judy Holliday. One's when they're having dinner in her apartment and the other is in that bar. And they're singing and playing the piano together and singing a song. And he's telling her he wants her to marry him, but not yet.
Why not now?
Because he wants her to get this fame stuff out of her system first. And you know, they're real happy together and they're having like this nice moment. And the bar's full of people.
Everything, or just a little more ready to, well,
it's like there's real people talking to each other.
Fall in love, though I shouldn't.
And then the television interrupts.
Gladys Glover.
Yeah?
And it, just like Matthew says, they call her name Gladys and she thinks it's a person.
Oh, he's talking about me.
Looks around. And she goes up to the television and stares at it. And then there's a shot of Jack Lemmon's face, and you know, he says, oh, he's lost her.
Namely, oh, gosh. That's very poignant. You're right. She's got a quirky voice, but she's also a wonderful physical comedian.
There's lots of interesting gags throughout this, visually and verbally, throughout the whole movie. I felt that it was very much like a movie from the French New Wave, because it was just about people, and we have this relationship between the couple, and then she's grappling with the media and how they want to use her. And then most of it is shot in on location, like a Woody Allen film from a couple decades later, but also like the films of François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard from the French New Wave.
Funny you should mention François Truffaut. Here's what the director had to say in 1954, when he was writing for arts newspapers and magazines. He wrote, "The theme of It Should Happen to You is marvelous. There's much more than a tasteful diversion. If you look carefully, you see the whole mechanism of celebrity against the background of the absurd. The moral of the story is that it is easier to find glory than to justify it, and that such glory has little meaning since it is acquired within a society that is unconscious of its absurdity."
You know, and then he goes on to praise it for its being a comic masterpiece, and that Cukor is one of the great film directors and a genius, and that he and Garson Kanin have made an almost perfect movie.
And that was collected in the book The Films in My Life by François Truffaut from Simon & Schuster.
I can go along with that. There's a marvelous scene when Judy Holliday comes back to the apartment building, and here's Jack Lemmon. He's outside and he's moved in there, but she doesn't quite know it. And they're talking. The camera is set up kind of next to the building, kind of looking down at the stoop. And in the background, you see this, the canyons of New York just goes all the way to the horizon. Now, if this had been shot in Hollywood, we would have looked straight on to the apartment building and, you know, just to hide that and just suggest it's in the background. But here in this film, Charles Lang is the cinematographer on this. A great shot of New York. I mean, you can't fake it. I mean, nowadays you could fake it pretty well. But back then, it's actually on the street. So we see them talking actually out in New York, and then they walk inside and a very nice cut to the studio set. And here we have these nice little series of tracking shots as they go up the stairs and they go to his apartment, and then they go down the hall to her apartment. And the whole time she's trying to get him to go to Columbus Circle. She won't tell him why, but she thinks that he'll see something at Columbus Circle.
Say, you happen to be over around Columbus Circle lately this week?
No.
Why don't you go up there sometime?
What for?
Oh, look around.
At what?
Different things.
Such as what?
Different signs.
Signs?
Sure, don't you ever look at signs?
I suppose so.
Take my word. If you go up there around Columbus Circle, yeah, you'll see something.
So she follows him into his apartment, and she goes to the window to think that there's a view. But once she sees that she can't see anything out of his apartment, she has him come down to her apartment. And so here we have, again, even though we have this nice dialogue going on, we're establishing the geography of where their apartments are within the building. And then she gets him to her apartment and she has him look out the window. Now, we've seen the billboard, but we see that there's all these buildings in the way, and it's way down at the end of the alley, and we only see one corner of the building. So we can recognize it, but unfortunately, Jack Lemmon doesn't know what we're looking at. You can see the billboard from her kitchen window, but it's way down at the end of an alley, and there's all these buildings, and you only see the corner of it. And since we've already seen it, we know it's there. But Jack Lemmon, he looks down there, and it's just like this abstract painting of shapes and lines.
Notice anything?
No, what?
What's the matter with your eyesight, anyhow?
Nothing.
And we see it, but then we also see what he's not seeing, or know what he's not seeing.
It's called dramatic irony, Matthew. Yeah.
Visually, it's really a great little scene. It justifies how great a director Cukor is, and he's been kind of overlooked.
I think you make a really good point about the realism, that it's a realist comedy, and it really is. And it's so interesting that Truffaut talked about the absurdity of wanting fame in an unconscious environment. And what the French, of course, would recognize as being unconscious, the Americans, the United Statesians, would call, you know, being all American. And they turn, and Judy Hall, that's why Judy Hall is perfect for this, because she plays the naive blonde, which is such a trope in American filmmaking, but she's so smart. Underneath it, somewhat in the way that Marilyn Monroe did that too. She put that intelligence underneath it. But Peter Lawford wants to turn her into this all-American girl. You'll be our spokesgirl for our soap because you are the all-American girl. So all of a sudden, she's gone from being just a name on a billboard. Now she's the all-American girl because, of course, she is completely unconscious. She's Camus' absurd person because there's nothing underneath any of her actions or any of her feelings. She's just this all-American girl, which means she's just surface. So she washes with the soap and she looks clean, but there's nothing there.
At one point, Jack Lemmon says, "You're the typical American girl because there is nothing typical about you."
But what Jack Lemmon does see, and this is what is so tender and proletariat about Garrison Keene and Judy Holliday, what this is the proletariat message in the film, is that every single person does matter. Every single person is somebody. And she isn't just the all-American girl. She isn't just some dumb blonde. He sees that her eccentricity is really kind of a doorway into her intelligence and into her individuality. And he loves her for that.
So we've been talking to Lisa Neville and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time about George Cukor and Garson Keenan's It Should Happen to You, a movie made in 1954, but more timely than ever.
Now, it's streaming, I guess, if you go to Amazon, but you can get some DVDs. This is just an overlooked masterpiece. Really.
It's great talking to you guys. And I'm feeling a sense of vertigo because I think that may be what we'll be talking about next. Maybe later in December or early 2023. Well, if we'll last that long.
You can follow the thread because later in 1954, Judy Holliday and Jack Lemmon made another movie together, their only other movie together. It's not nearly so good. It's just a light film. But it also stars Kim Novak in her
film. Oh!
And in 1958, Jack Lemmon would star with Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart in Bell, Book, and Candle.
Yeah, that's all interconnected. It must be a conspiracy of some kind.
Hollywood.
Anyway,
Hollywood.
Great talking to you guys. We will see you again next month or early next year. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching your screens.
Giants defeated Chicago 5-3. Cincinnati beat St. Louis 10-9. Brooklyn whitewashed Pittsburgh.
We might have been meant for each other.
I only had the money.
It isn't a question of money, believe me, kid.
I could have been on the covers of matchboxes, pencils, anything you can think of.
We're going to have a long talk in a few days, Gladys. In fact, several long talks. In fact, we may end up talking. What do you think?
Let's fall in love. Now, why shouldn't we fall in love?
Gladys Glover.
Da, da, da. Yeah?
Gladys Glover.
Oh, he's talking about me.
Well, it's the subject for your Manhattan nightcap for tonight. Many New Yorkers are speculating as to the answer to one of the most unimportant questions of the day. Namely, who or what is Gladys Glover?
Did you hear that?
Now, signs bearing this mysterious name seem to be appearing all over our town, but it's this department's guess that Gladys Glover...
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board...